Hello and welcome to The Librarian is In, the New York Public Library's podcast about books, culture, and what to read next. My name is Frank.
And my name is Rhonda.
My name is Barbara. Do you know that record? Barbara Streisand?
Yes, I do.
Oh, you know everything. You're a
I'm a huge Barbara Streisand fan, so that's
Are you?
Yes.
You know, I just
Barbara.
Came out of nowhere, but I just watched her recent concert on Netflix because I happened to get a someone shared a subscription. I don't know how it works. But one late night I stumbled upon it and I watched it and I cried and cried.
Well, which concert is this?
It's the Magic Memories and Mayhem or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's one of her more recent ones. And because like my mother loved her and I grew up with her records and she's, you know, we went to see Yentl on opening night and,
ooh.
And, it was just a memory of childhood in a way of hearing her voice and hearing her voice. Like actually she's used to be like indomitable and she is indomitable, but like there's a slight change in her voice, you know, doesn't dilute the power, but it's different and that shows a little bit of age and growing older. And I, you know, just having her around was just like, I realized how she's been a part of my life since I was a child because my mother loved her.
Oh, I know. I love her. I love Color Me Barbara. Do you remember that? That was just, can we just talk about Barbara Streisand?
I know. I love how I didn't even know that. Color Me Barbara. I know there was a TV show.
Yeah, she had a special. And the special that when she was on the Judy Garland show. Oh, my God. I love those duets.
If anyone hasn't, they should get themselves in a position to see the duets that Judy Garland and Barbara Streisand did on Judy Garland's show when Judy Garland was in her 40s and Barbara Streisand was like 21.
Yeah, she was just coming out.
Unbelievable. It's like an unbelievable duet because they're both powerhouses, but they both shine and they both seem to be dealing with each other in a loving way. There's not like a, I'm going to oversing you, even though either of them could in some ways.
Yeah.
It's just gorgeous.
I think like Ethel Merman made some kind of appearance and Barbara didn't seem too pleased. I don't know. It's very entertaining.
Rhonda, I agree with you. I don't know. I think we could talk about this for a whole.
We could.
Because I've seen those clips as well when Ethel Merman comes on and she just like, she oversings. Well, she just powerhouses her way through the trio. And Barbara may be annoyed, but she looks like she just sort of says, I'm not competing. I'm not doing this. She looks a little like, okay, but she lets Ethel take it. And it's an unusual experience to see a Barbara Streisand sort of muted a little bit.
Well, but that's because she wasn't the legend yet. She was with the legend. She was with Ethel Merman, with Judy Garland. So she was the new kid. So she had to, you know.
Exactly. Kind of
be in her place at that moment. Now it's a different story. But at the time, she wasn't Barbara, the icon and legend.
It's true. I know. I think that's very gracious. Let's go with that. She wasn't. I mean, we look at it now as with her as a legend, but at the time, Ethel Merman was like the supremo with Judy Garland.
Exactly.
I know they're amazing. So I saw that concert, one of her most recent, I guess, and you know, she just you know, suggests so much. Like I said, I remember my mother cleaning the house to The Way We Were. You know, playing The Way We Were and Stony End and just like bopped out to it. And I loved the Funny Lady soundtrack. Oh my God. Anyway.
You bring back so many memories. I don't know. Maybe this week when I'm cleaning, I'm going to have to put on my Barbara Streisand essential hits.
Oh my God. I love that we just discovered that, which has nothing to do with the poetry of Mary Oliver, but maybe it does.
Does
life
it?
Is life. I don't know.
So maybe we should start.
Yeah, I know.
Mary Oliver.
Went off on a Barbara tangent.
I could talk about
My
Barbara.
Name is Barbara. All right.
Pretty good. We should do a duet.
Do you sing?
No.
Well, I don't either. We can get the producer to auto-tune us or something.
Exactly. That might work.
Is there a Barbara Streisand filter, audio filter?
Yeah. And she has so many good duets. We could do You Don't Bring Me Flowers. Oh.
See, that made me cry. She did that on her... I mean, I was just a mess, like that late night watching this. And it was really just all about the past and growing up and yeah, having her around still. And I can't imagine a world in which she doesn't exist. So,
yeah, we're not talk.
Right. We're stopping. We're not going to talk about that. Barbara's going to live forever.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So we read... you and I, Rhonda, we read a book from the New York Public Library is 125 Books We Love. And the book is Mary Oliver, American Primitive, a book of poetry from the early 80s was published. She won the Pulitzer for it in 84. And I had never read Mary Oliver. I've heard of her, of course. And I thought it would be, and you thought it would be, fun to dig into it, or interesting. So we did, and I hope everybody out there did too, or will. So, thoughts, comments, feelings?
Yeah, so it's, you know, this is our first time discussing poetry, and it was a little kind of intimidating, I guess, to think about it, because I don't know, to me, poetry is, as a reader, I guess, a little intimidating, and maybe that other people feel that way, because I feel like it's an art, but it's also kind of a science to it. I remember in college, I took a poetry class about writing poetry. It was like an elective. And I remember we had a book and it had all of these like terms and these different formats and all these different kind of ways and new language to speak about poetry. And I'm like, you kind of have this, it seems like you kind of have to have a certain vocabulary to do that. So I don't know. That was kind of like my thoughts kind of coming into this is how do I, you know, what's the proper way to really talk about poetry, or if there is a way to talk about poetry?
Yeah. I mean, it feels like it's a you know, like opera or something. It's a secret language, and you know there's power and like high emotion there, but you feel, one might feel they cannot access mm-hmm. it because it's a vocabulary, like you put, that's something to be learned that you can't just listen or read it. You have to sort of know something other to get it. Yeah. I mean, I've lost a little bit of that intimidation over the years, but I do understand that feeling mm-hmm. about how to talk about it. And it took a while in thinking about Mary Oliver and American Primitive to sort of realize it's okay. I can talk about whatever I want. And that's what I end up doing anyway.
Yeah.
Much to the chagrin of all the listeners. But it's funny you should say access, because I did, of course, a little reading about Mary Oliver, which you might have as well, Miss Reason mm-hmm. Queen, that she's considered one of the most, in quotes, accessible poets, mm-hmm. which might be a criticism or a compliment, depending on right. where it's coming from. Because again, maybe implicit in our intimidation is that if it's too accessible, it's not worth it.
Yeah. And that kind of seems, like you said, reading about her and about what people have written about her, you know, that does seem to be on some circles a bit of a criticism that it's too, I don't know the word that they were, I don't know if accessible was the word that they were using, but she, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's complex enough. It's too, I don't know.
Well, she deals with what one may call, in quotes, old-fashioned issues. Like she talks a lot about nature, mm-hmm. The beauty of nature and walking through nature and being in the natural world. And that might seem like a sort of Wordsworthian old tiny subject for now, or for the 70s and 80s and 90s when she was publishing a lot. And also like her, a lot of her Mary Oliver's quotes are memes online. You know, people have used her to get a point across because she's very accessible, which might seem lowbrow to some people. Mm-hmm. The high lowbrow thing we don't even have to get into unless you want to, because I don't care.
Yeah, that, you know, yeah. I think that's probably where a lot of that kind of criticism falls into those different camps. But, you know, and again, talking about, you know, the subject matter of what she writes about, yeah, a lot of the nature. What I did read about her was that this was her kind of communing with nature, was really her saving grace in life, that she had kind of this, you know, problematic childhood. There were some things that happened to her, and that her starting at a very young age, these walks through the woods and just in hours observing the birds and the trees and the water was what really just kind of saved her life in a way. Just,
yeah,
her in a place of peace. And that's where she would even do a lot of her writing. So I think that this is kind of beautiful, that this is what inspires her.
I mean, I wonder what brings that about. I mean, I know she said she didn't want enclosure, like the enclosure of four walls, and she wanted to be out of the house and outside. I mean, but like that ability to, which she's also famous for, pay attention to the world around her and see it. You know, she doesn't know how it happened, and one doesn't know how it happened. It made me think, and this is what I meant about you can say anything, because poetry can just inspire something that's personal to you. I mean, that's the point of it sometimes too, is to contemplate. Like, I loved being outside as a kid and grew up in suburbia, but I don't remember the natural world as being specific. It was very generalized. It was trees and grass and rocks and dirt, but I didn't really say it didn't. I did not have the brain or the ability or the happenstance or luck to really see. I feel like I had to really see it. I loved being in it and getting dirty and stuff like that, but I didn't see it. And yeah, did you grow up around nature?
Well, it's interesting because she grew up in Ohio. I grew up in Ohio.
Really?
Yeah, but not near where she lived. And I think I liked being outdoors, but like you said, it wasn't like how she was, you know, really just sitting and really just being able to almost kind of be still and just observe the world around her. And I kind of think that's why I did enjoy reading some poems from this book, because I think kind of thinking about the way things are now and how many distractions that we have to be able to go out someplace like in the woods and just sit and just watch the natural, you know, goings on of birds,
yeah,
and bugs and snakes and things that she wrote about, and to have that ability to kind of do that now, to just sit. I don't know how many people could do that, or if I could do it. Maybe people do it, but
I know. I mean, like, it definitely was about focus and attention, and it did make me feel at some point, oh, I wish I had been able to do that. Why couldn't I do that? What's failing in me that I didn't? And it did bring around the question of like, well, I sort of did crave an urban life, and of course, nature. Like, I'm grateful I have one tree outside my window in New York, and I revel in it and watch the leaves fall and watch them come back and watch them move when it's windy. And I have that one tree and I feel like that's great. I have the one tree and I used to say that's my one bit of green and that's enough. So like, what is it to revel in, like, what's the difference of reveling in the so-called natural world as opposed to an urban environment? Like, the urban environment excites people, interests people, the architectural detail, the urban excitement. I mean, I wonder how Mary Oliver would feel about that. If there's an interchange, or there is a separateness, I don't know. I mean, I think one thing that came up along those lines is when I first started reading it, I stopped and said to myself, we have to stop maybe it's just me, but separating this idea of us and nature. Like, we keep saying the natural world as if we're not part of it. it seems so important to say we are 100% a part of it. We're 100% in the natural world. I mean, we're all in the world, right? I mean, but yet, and again, a big thing for me, the language we use or can use is, seems to separate us as if we're different or special or stronger or smarter than the natural world. And right. I think we sometimes can feel like we are, and then, you know, horribly natural disasters occur, or we are focused on the butterfly flying by and feel amazing and realize how we're not, and how we're prey to it and part of it.
Yeah. And I think like being in an urban environment, like we are in New York City, you do feel, or I feel kind of disconnected from it, because the animals that I see, you know, are domesticated animals or the, you know, the New York pigeons, which most people hate. And even when you go to a park or someplace like that, it's never just you and nature. There's probably like 20 other people and on their phones. And so sometimes maybe it's worth like removing yourself from these kind of concrete jungles and going somewhere for a few days where you can just be with nature. And actually it's interesting that that is becoming a thing now. I think during the pandemic is people are kind of advertising these getaways where you can live in like one of the little tiny houses out in nature by yourself for a few weeks. So maybe it's something to think about.
I can definitely feel from her poetry that sense of course, we've all, no matter what, I think, had the moments, all of us, where we were in nature and felt something different than we ever really usually feel. I mean, that connection or fear of or separation. I mean, but something different, because it is maybe as biological, you know, or whatever the word you want to use, biological organisms responding to other, they're not biological, I guess, but like, what am I trying to say? What is the word? Not biological, but, and I don't want to say natural, but, or human, but living things that we're all of this world.
Right.
Uncreated by, well, maybe the core is uncreated by the human touch. Like we didn't create trees.
Right. Okay.
We created the Empire State Building, but we didn't create trees. Right. We're as created as they are from wherever and however we've been created. We've been created equally in a way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And maybe that's like, that's a familial kinship that we seek. I don't know.
Yeah.
You're gonna say?
I feel like this is another topic that we could probably spend hours.
I know. I know.
So let's jump in.
Well, yeah. Did you have a poem that you felt?
Yeah, I marked a few that really stood out to me, and we kind of didn't agree or discuss, you know, which poems that we were going to read. So I don't know. One of the ones that I really it kind of struck me, I guess, was, did you read The Lost Children?
Yes. I read the whole book. So okay. That's why I didn't bother contacting you about, like, what are we going to read together? I was like, I read the whole book, so whatever she brings up, I can understand. Yes, I did The Lost Children.
Well, now, was that one that kind of stood out to you, or?
It did. And it made me think about why, because I definitely cleaved towards the poems that had people in them.
Me too.
Which are not many. right. Besides the speaker, the top speaker of the poem. And that made me question too, like, why can I not fully engage with her natural world? But yes, it was notable because there were people.
Right. Exactly. That's what I was going to say. I did the same thing. The ones that had people in them were really the ones that I kind of bookmarked, like, okay, I connected with this one a little bit more. And also I think because for someone who doesn't read poetry a lot, which I would like to read more, you know, after this, I feel like the ones that have people in it tell a story. So that also kind of brought me in to that poem a little bit more, because The Lost Children definitely tells a story. And the other ones tell a story too. But this one, you know, it's almost like, you know, you have a beginning, middle, and end here.
Yeah.
Right. Characters. Yeah.
So, well, because some of the poems that I like too were also about, which we'll get to, but darker emotions, as you can imagine. There are some purely joyful poems about eating honey and or a bear sauntering through the woods that are just very tactile and sensuous about living in the natural world. But yes, you're right. So The Lost Children, though.
So I guess, you know, how we should go about is it's broken up into different parts. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, oh no, 7 parts to this poem.
But all her poems are, you know, usually a page, not much more. This one is 3.
Yeah, 3 pages.
So it's one of the longer ones.
Right. And we have, there's 2, you know, it kind of tells a story, I guess, of, you know, again, it's very, very closely related to nature, like all of the other poems in this book. But it talks more about these 2 people and their kind of how their life was changed, I guess, by this connection to nature and the people who were connected to them. And it starts, I guess, with Lydia Osborne. She talks about a long time ago. So it seems, you know, from reading the poem that we might be in the colonial days, because they talk about Native Americans and, you know, being in Ohio and Kentucky, and it kind of just puts you in that place. And at 11 years old, it talks about kind of her last seen walk through nature, this young girl, and how she's missing and people are looking for her, and how they found these little different points of where she has left her kind of imprint on nature. They found where she slept under 2 fallen trees and eaten fox grapes, and a little house that she built of sticks and her footprints by a stream. And how these are kind of the last pieces that her family ever see of her, are these little imprints of nature. And then the grief that they have of not really knowing where these clues have led to her. And that's kind of the first 2 parts of this poem. I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to say about those parts.
Well, it's called The Lost Children. Mm-hmm. It seemed as if, I mean, with the first part with Lydia, the 11-year-old girl, it sort of has her parents looking for her, imagining the terrible possibilities of where she could have possibly gone. She just wandered away. And the second story is of Isaac Zane, who's 9 years old. And it seems as if he was taken by the Native American population. Mm-hmm. That he was, which then goes on to, what does it go on to?
It, to me, and this is how I read it, you know, with Isaac, you know, he grows up with these, with the Native Americans. And then he says he left the streets and returned. And for 50 years, they lived together. And this is talking about an Indian girl, Myree, the white crane that he meets. And I guess he lives with her. And to me, I was thinking that was Lydia. Was that what you were thinking, Frank?
Oh, no.
Okay, so that's what I thought, because there's another section saying, you know, that her kind of going back to Lydia's story, thinking that she may have been taken also by Native Americans. And the fact that she's called, you know, this Indian girl is called the White Crane.
Oh.
And in my mind, I'm like, oh, this is beautiful. She has, you know, she goes off into nature and finds her way and lives with this Native Americans. And he's stolen and he leaves, but then he comes back and he finds her. And these kind of lost children find each other. That's how I could be wrong, but that's what I saw in this story.
I think that's very perceptive. I didn't see it. But yet I think you're right. Because the detail of the white crane and the tribe, I mean, and they raise both of them basically, and they both seem happy for it.
Right.
So there is that element of children, these children returning again to a more natural or better world, which is interesting because it's a kidnapping, I suppose. I mean, it's not said explicitly, but it's definitely made clear that the children prefer the world of the tribe that they've been adopted by, shall we say, right?
Right. And I think, yeah. And I think one part that I thought was really, you know, kind of significant to this, all of it significant, but stood out to me for this poem was part five. And it's short, so I'll read it.
Okay.
It says, part five is, I'm sorry for grief. I said that. But I think the girl knelt down somewhere in the woods and drank the cold water of some wild stream and wanted to live. I think Isaac caught dancing feet. I think death has no country. Love has no name. And I was like, well.
Yeah.
You know?
Because that's the authorial voice talking.
Right, yeah.
Like, I'm sorry for grief. I said that refers to the people the children left behind.
Exactly.
Parents. But yet the girl and the boy wanted to live, meaning they weren't living where they were originally.
Exactly.
But they came alive with the tribe that took them.
Mm-hmm. And death has no country.
Yeah.
And love has no name. You know?
Which means...
That's what got me thinking kind of what that meant.
I mean, yeah, as you referred to, I mean, this is, the text should stand alone, but, you know, you refer to Mary Oliver's troubled childhood. It does seem to dovetail a bit into that it doesn't mean much per se where you've grown up, how you've lived, mm-hmm. where you find your life.
Mm, yes, where you find your, yeah, where you find your place.
Right.
Because I guess, like, you know, it
finding
could,
your place.
Right, relate to how she grew up. And like you said, the girl wanted to live. And even though she's leaving all these grief, you know, behind her, this is kind of what she had to do. And then Isaac caught dancing feet.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because that's one of the things I made a note about when I was reading the poems in general was that, and one poem that deals explicitly with this is why, how do we live in a world of no answers? Mm-hmm. Because she says in, I don't remember the name of the poem, but she says in one of the poems, actually, the first snow, she says, you know, there are no answers. Like, how do we live in this world? There are no answers. Like, what are the questions? But, you know, just walking through the woods seems to feel like an answer, or just to be among the natural world seems like an answer. Mm-hmm. But is it the answer? And I thought, wow, we so appear to be that difference I was saying before about how we might divide the natural world and human beings is that we seem to feel like we're the only questing animals. We're the only questioning animals about why we even exist. Mm-hmm. Even though we don't know that for sure. I mean, right. The python might be like, I beg to differ. I actually wonder why I'm alive as well. We might not know, but we feel like we are, and that might be the separating thing. And we're questing, looking emotionally and intellectually for a place to be. Like, what inspired me is that you said there, these kids and the lost children were looking for a place to be, mm-hmm. Or whether they knew it or not, and they found it. They found it surprisingly and unexpectedly. And then it made me think, like, why, again, the separation, like I said before about humanity versus the natural world, but also why we separate emotion and intellect.
Right.
Which this poem also seems to deal with, and that intellect ultimately serves emotion. Like we think and try to rationalize and understand to feel better or feel like we understand or to feel joy or to feel something. Mm-hmm. And again, that intellect through emotion is also in the service of getting us to a place to be, that we feel at home and at peace. And Mary Oliver in this poem that you just read partly, is these kids, she calls it the lost children, but they've basically been found. They found each other.
Right. They found each other. I think they found their place where they can, as she said, they wanted to live where they can live, love, you know, without having any kind of, she says, no name, no label to it, maybe. I don't know.
Don't act like me. I'm the one that says, I don't know.
I don't know. I don't. I feel like there's, as always, you know, this is the one that I kept kind of coming back to and thinking about. So, and again, I think partly because there was a clear kind of story and characters in this. So I was like, oh, this is, you know, I can kind of really, I can easily connect with this, as, you know, more so than I did with some of the other poems. And again, like all of the kind of poems that I flagged to talk about had people in them. And
which are not a lot. I mean, that is not by any means the majority, right?
And yeah, and there was one that I flagged, and, you know, we don't have to talk about this one next, but that almost kind of felt out of place.
I think I know what you're going to say, but...
Which one did you think it was?
Is it the poem called Something?
Oh, no. Okay. Maybe look at that. I was looking at the one Flying.
Oh.
When she's on the airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and you know, there's also one about a whorehouse. So that also.
Well, not an actual one, but the ruins.
A ruins of a whorehouse. Yeah, but I was thinking the one about flying when she's on the airplane. And I'm like, that's an interesting kind of, it's like almost like, well, in the copy that I have, it's like right in the middle of the book too. And so.
I like that. Yeah. Flying and the old whorehouse, which is the other one, did strike me too, because the flying one was like almost that, she's observing a man and his profile and just saying how beautiful you are and how lovely. And I just want to touch you in a way. Sort of that joy of seeing beauty, but this time in the amongst humans rather than between us. Right. Again, I'm separating, but between us and the natural world. Did you remember it that way?
I did. And also because it's so far removed from nature, you know, being in this completely, as you said, kind of man-made thing, far, 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 you know, above the clouds, you know, taking her out of the setting of like the woods and the nature, and you're just, you know, being in this enclosed thing and still finding, I guess, you know, still finding beauty wherever you are.
Right. That's right. There.
Yeah.
It does end with her flying. And then she ends though with, the observation of the landscape below, thousands of feet below.
Right.
When he's gone, it ends when she's talking about the man she had observed on the plane. When he's gone, you stare like an animal into the blinding clouds with the snapped chain of your life, the life you know. The deeply affectionate earth, the familiar landscape slowly turning thousands of feet below. Actually, it almost seems like that when she says the snap chain of your life, that the human connection is not the real life for her. It's not the life you know. It's the, because I just saw that the life you know, that punctuation, the life you know, meaning, which is the deeply affectionate earth, the familiar landscape. So she's actually, it's an aberration in a way, flying through the air and almost maybe leads to an aberration of thought, not a negative way per se, but she sees beauty, but it's not the world she knows below.
Oh, right.
Interesting.
It is. And then kind of, she starts the poem saying, you know, sometimes on a plane, you see a stranger and he's so beautiful. And the thing is that she's not just looking at him and observing how beautiful she is. She is compelled to kind of get up out of her seat and actually touch him, touch this person that is so beautiful. And, you know, I just thought that, again, relating to kind of what you said, what she knows, the deeply affectionate earth and the familiar landscapes, yeah, of actually seeing this person and thinking that they're so beautiful that she has to touch them.
I think I would hazard to say that I think all of us, when we're in an enclosed space, like a train or a plane, or we're in a waiting room or something, have observed another person that we suddenly feel a little bit like, huh. I think you know what I mean.
Okay.
A little bit of attraction, connection, sensuality, maybe. Am I wrong? Tell me I'm wrong.
I don't think you're wrong, but I don't know if that's I don't know if that's how I read this.
No, I think, well, I didn't mean it like she was, here I go with the romance again. I didn't mean it quite that way, but I think what she meant, and that I'm also trying to display, is an unexpected moment of connection and beauty with another human being. And then, as you pointed out, it goes on to really say, when you find that, you just want to touch it. And I, you know, again, I don't mean it per se sexually. It's just this connection thing. It's definitely about connection in a visceral way. And she says, what you find on the earth somewhere shining and unexpected and without thinking, reach for. That's what I'm really riffing on, is that without thinking,
right?
Like we're in that waiting room and we observe someone, and really without thinking, we feel a yearning for them, or we want to reach for them. You stand there shaken by the strangeness, the splash of his touch. When he's gone, you stare like an animal into the blinding clouds at the snap chain of your life. Actually, it could mean that the temporality of human connection is temporal, and the connection with the natural world is permanent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see that too. I see that, yeah.
That people leave, or the snap chain, like it's done. They're gone. They leave the plane or the waiting room, and it's that connection is maybe done. But then she sees and Mary Oliver actually just said this about herself. The world, when she was a child and went out into the nature, it was always there for her. It was always there.
Always. Yeah. And the plane is always such kind of the setting of a plane is such a temporary, you know, a temporary thing where you are connected in a way with all of these people.
Right.
Kind of stuck just for a short period of time with these people, no escape, you know, and you have those moments of we're all kind of whatever this is in this one experience together.
Huh. That, yeah. I actually have a poem among a few that I noted, but one that deals more with her being in the woods, in, for lack of a better term, the natural world. And like I said, some of them are, especially what she's most noted and remembered for, at least culturally, her sort of her sort of joyful evocations of nature. And this one has a darker side, which is, of course, something that appeals to me. It's the poem called Cold Poem.
Okay.
And, well, I'll just read it, actually. It's called Cold Poem. Cold now, close to the edge, almost unbearable. Clouds bunch up and boil down from the north of the white bear. This tree-splitting morning, I dream of his fat tracks, the life-saving suet. I think of summer with its luminous fruit, blossoms rounding to berries, leaves, handfuls of grain. Maybe what cold is the time we measure the love we have always had, secretly, for our own bones. The hard, knife-edged love for the warm river of the eye, beyond all else. Maybe that is what it means, the beauty of the blue shark cruising toward the tumbling seals. In the season of snow, in the immeasurable cold, we grow cruel but honest. We keep ourselves alive if we can, taking one after another the necessary bodies of others, the many crushed red flowers. Wow, that's up my alley. Would you say?
I said there are definitely some dark undertones there.
When she says the hard knife-edged love for the warm river of the eye, it's not the eyeball, it's the capital I. So I actually like this poem because it like we talked about the critical aspect to Mary Oliver, that she's accessible and just talks about the joyfulness of nature, is that she doesn't do that all the time, and not even all predominantly. She talks about the violence and of nature and our part in it. And I think this is sort of an interesting evocation of that, because she says, you know, when it gets cold, it's almost unbearable. Mm-hmm. And that cold, as she ruminates, you know, maybe is that time when we realize, or when we have to be very much for our own self. We have to survive. Mm-hmm. And she even says, like, the sort of life-saving suet, like the fat of the bear, which can be, you know, in summer, the bear is a beautiful part of the world that she's observing. But in winter, it actually could save one's life. Like,
right.
I think The Revenant with Leonardo DiCaprio had a moment about a bear. But where we're living in it or eating it or being the life savings fat that you need in cold weather. I mean, so, you know, that brings you, she says, cruel, but honest, because it is. And that's what I mean about it. It's not like joyful nature all the time. It's like, it's honest that we animals as well as humans, all of us, have to survive, and sometimes it means the other has to die for us.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like she said that.
I was thinking about that last stanza.
Yeah, and then right before that, she says the beauty of the blue shark cruising toward the tumbling seals. I mean that has to impact a lot of us. Like that idea of a shark going to basically eat a seal. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't love a seal? And then, but she's saying the beauty of the blue shark cruising toward the tumbling seal. So she's basically saying it's part of it. It's beautiful because it's part of it. It's right. Part of life. It's our life. And it's disingenuous of us to say that we're not amongst that. And that, like she says, if we can, taking one after another, the necessary bodies of others to survive, which is, I guess, cruel, but honest. So
it is.
Anyone who thinks Mary Oliver is all like sunshine and daffodils.
I feel like there's a lot of, to me, and just bring my own kind of, you know, knowledge of to this. I feel a lot of kind of history in this poem, in the season of this, of snow, in the immeasurable cold, we grow cruel, but honest. We keep ourselves alive, if we can, taking one after another, the necessary bodies of others. And I kind of think in a literal sense, you know, you hear throughout, you know, American history, and she also, you know, connecting to her other poems where we kind of get this, you know, what's the term that I'm not colonial, but kind of early American kind of imagery with the Native Americans, you know, and just this whole idea of survival. And when the hardest time for human beings to survive is most often the winter, right? Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the first thing we think of is like the Donner Party, you know, who mm-hmm. were trapped in the Sierra Mountains and feet of snow and had to actually use each other's bodies to survive. And then again, like, you know, there's also a lot of like folklore and folk tales throughout American history about the different ways that human beings have had to survive throughout the winter. And that this is kind of when we have to become the sharks, right? When you have to do what you have to do to get through nature's meanest moments, I guess you would say.
Yes. And I like what you said in that the weather, AKA the natural world, again, mm-hmm. informs all of us animals, and our society, like how we come together, how we function. So the summer can be blossoms, fruit, and grain. It sounds like there's, in other words, there's plenty. There's plenty to so-called survive, eat and survive, that doesn't seem to so-called cause grief. But that the winter comes along and it's all about red flesh and fat. You know, it's all about surviving. And it, I love that line. You're right. And you said it again, the cruel makes, it makes us cruel, but honest. That's an important thing. That, again, we could talk about that for a long time, because acknowledging what is true is such a difficult, difficult process. I mean, how many of us want to say we're sometimes cruel or can be cruel? And then also from there, acknowledge it as it is, and not necessarily anything other than what it is, you know, not a life pounding pejorative, but a necessary function.
Right. She says, taking one after another, the necessary bodies of others.
That's edging into a whole, like you referred to about Native Americans, a whole situation that is painful to talk about.
Right, and the many crushed red flowers.
I know, it's like, ugh. I mean, what this suggests is true, but how necessary and hopeful. I mean, almost to be hopeful that it's not as necessary. You know what I mean? Like, I'm basically talking about enslaving or war.
Right, and another thing, yeah, that I was thinking about when I was in it, and so it's a little bit of a side, but not much. I do listen to a podcast, another podcast, about kind of folklore, American folklore. And the one that I listened to most recently was talking about this kind of American folktale of this man who spends, you know, goes to this kind of boarding house for the winter. And he sees that the people who live in this house have given all of their elderly people, their elderly family, this drug. And the drug kind of puts them in this coma state. And they take the elderly people and they put them out in the snow for a few days, and then they put them in a box and then they bury it. And he kind of asked them, you know, like, well, what are you doing with your elder members? Are they dead? Like, what's happening? And they say, no, you know, you come back in the spring and we'll show you. And so he comes back in the spring, and they have given these people kind of this drug so that they could take out a certain number of people so they could survive the winter and have their food. And then they would bring the elderly people back, you know, from their coma or whatever this thing is. And kind of he's saying what this means is this desire to extend life, right? To extend the lives of ourselves, to kind of extend the lives of others through whatever means is available to us. And I kind of also see that in this, in the cold poem, as it's called, of not just, you know, the beauty of the blue shark and the necessary bodies, but also this just desire to kind of extend, that we have this natural instinct to do what we have to do to extend life, even through its, you know, harshest moments. Yeah.
Rhonda. Oh my God. I mean, now you've got me thinking about the term necessary bodies. I mean, that's the great thing about poetry. I think you just sort of led us there, that to ruminate on just a line or a phrase, and a novel, you can do that too, but obviously there's a bigger in terms of volume world out there in a novel, whereas poetry can lead you more specifically to contemplate just phrases and words, which I love, and you could spend a long time thinking about what it means. And you just actually explained it, or your viewpoint, wonderfully. It's almost like, I know people have done this before, but like just to read a little, like Mary Oliver, or frame or phrase or a passage, or her poems are mostly very short, every morning, just to sort of start your language going. Because like I always say, these words give ourselves meaning.
I had the desire to kind of do that after I was reading it in the morning too. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, what a kind of good way to start the day with some
specifically poetry. You know, it's a story, which a story I thought of when I was reading this too, that struck me so hard, because I'm And you just brought up an outside story as well that related to it. Like the author Graham Greene, I'm actually reading a book of his for my book discussion group in the library called The End of the Affair. But I remember reading a quote, and I should have looked it up before, but I didn't know I was going to talk about it. That Graham Greene had witnessed a terrible situation. A child had died, and the mother was in the hospital crying and talking to the doctor. And he was somehow overheard this, Graham Greene. And he said her grief, absolutely notwithstanding, that was just pure and there. He said the language she was using about the situation, about her own child being gone, was of the most prosaic and meaningless prattle, that it was just borrowed language, that it was language that she picked up from the culture. And say what you will, you could say Graham Greene's a big old snob. But what I took him to say was that she didn't have access to language for herself. Mm-hmm. I think she didn't have true language to express her feeling about what happened. She had to use borrowed, trite, you could say, language. And there's a lot to debate in there, but I think ultimately what I took from it was that to find your own language that truly expresses you, that expresses your situation and what you really feel about life and challenging yourself. And I think that both poems we discussed do that. I mean, and your observations like helped me also find the phrases that I didn't know I was thinking about as much as I was. So does that make sense, what I just said?
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, just that it's important to me. I think it's all we've got. Like we're telling stories in our head all the time about our lives and what we're doing. And the more, the better vocabulary you have, you know, God knows it can help you. But back to Barbara.
But no, I think that's kind of a, I don't know if we're, you know, if we're, this is kind of a nice way to wrap it.
Yeah.
About reading poetry in the morning.
Yeah.
And kind of maybe how that can open up, you know, different ways, different vocabulary, different ways of thinking, of expressing yourself, of viewing the world. I mean, you can do, like you said, you can do that through any type of reading, but there's something different with poetry where you can really just kind of focus on a phrase or a few words, you know?
It's exactly the word, focus. And again, like it could be like this annoying, like irritating and anxious making thing, like, oh, reading poetry. Yeah, like if I don't get it, like, what does that mean? It just suddenly, because of the conversation with you, made me feel like you can read a phrase and let it carry with you or not.
Right.
You know, it might not adhere, but that focus, that momentary at least focus on those words, so important. Do you like Barbara's rendition of Being Alive?
Yes, of course I do.
One of my favorites. One of the great songs from Company, Stephen Sondheim.
That's from her Back to Broadway album, right?
I think so. You're my idol. I work with you.
I know everything. I love
Being Barbara. Alive.
She has a few songs from Company. Maybe she does. That's a great... great cover that she does.
And in a way, that song is very much like some of the poems we read, because it's like someone forced me to care, and like there's negatives about being in love, but those things that make you in love also make you feel alive. And Mary Oliver is certainly talking about being alive. Right.
And actually for years that was the only version of Being Alive that I've ever heard.
I didn't know that.
I've never heard anyone else sing it until I saw A Marriage Story on Netflix and someone else sings it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, that's Barbara's song, but it's really, you know, that's how I always felt.
It's from Company, and it was sung originally by a guy.
I know, yeah. That's who sang it in the movie I had watched.
It's another thing.
Barbara in my head singing it. So
the culture, the part of books culture and what to read next is that Marriage Story is such a good movie.
It is. So you've seen it.
Yeah.
So you saw the part where he's saying being alive. Right.
Yeah. Someone forced me to care.
Right. Yeah.
With Adam Driver, Scarlett Johansson, and Laura Dern. Well, Barbara and Mary Oliver.
There you go.
Who would have known such a juxtaposition would occur? Thank you, Rhonda. Really. Thank you so much. I totally enjoyed this conversation. I hope it was as interesting to listen to. One can hope. But it made her poems even more interesting to me to go back to. So,
yeah, absolutely.
So, thank you everybody for listening. And we shall be back soon with books that Rhonda and I are going to read on our own. Mm-hmm. And we will surprise each other with those titles. And hope everyone's okay out there and take care. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Next time.
Thanks for listening to The Librarian Is In, a podcast by the New York Public Library. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Play, or send us an email at podcasts@nypl.org. For more information about the New York Public Library and our 125th anniversary, please visit nypl.org/125. We are produced by Christine Farrell. Your hosts are Frank Kalarius and Rhonda Evans.